first case on calendar today is Parker v. Green. Ms. Mustel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please do. And let us know if you want to reserve any time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Rachel Mustel for the appellant. Your Honors, this case both is and yet shouldn't be complicated. At its heart, this case is nothing more than an alimony case. With regard to jurisdiction, this court has very clear jurisdiction over orders denying modification of alimony and orders failing to identify provision as alimony, including clarification of a term necessary to determine that fact. That is ultimately all this case is. The only reason there is even a potential question as to what this case is about is because of the inequity and complication created by respondent and her prior counsel in taking advantage of the appellant. The simple fact is that respondent had a very clever attorney who, in zealously advocating for her client, pulled the wool over the eyes of an unrepresented party. Ultimately, appellant, who is very clearly not savvy about the law, signed a decree believing it would have no actual impact on his relationship. It is true, appellant should have hired an attorney. It is equally true that appellant had no reason to believe that the party's interests were truly adverse, as there was going to be no change in their relationship as a result of this decree. It's clear from the terms of that agreement that the parties intended to stay together. Otherwise, there'd be no reason to put an exception in to the term of art that said this terminates on the party's remarriage, except if respondent enters into a second domestic partnership with appellant. If the parties' interests were truly adverse, if the parties were truly separating, there's no basis for that term. It is clear from that term that the parties were not terminating their relationship, and therefore my client had no reason to believe that the parties' interests were adverse. It's also true that respondent's counsel had an obligation in dealing with an unrepresented party to be more straightforward in her dealings with him than she would have been with an attorney. Instead, respondent and her counsel crafted an inequitable legal fiction to create a workaround in order to avoid all of the law set in place by the legislature and by this court, rather than openly negotiating a non-merged marital settlement agreement to have non-modifiable alimony. Despite respondent's cunning, this case and the provision at heart of this appeal is clearly alimony. The provision is misnamed, admittedly, which creates a complication because there is a second provision in the decree that waives alimony. Clarification of the term is therefore proper, even when more than 6 months has passed. The existence of alimony is a matter of law, which the court reviews de novo. In doing so, the court must look at the intent of the provision. And to do that, the court should start with the specific express language of the provision. In reviewing the language, how can the contested provision be anything other than alimony?
It looks to me like it's like liquidated damages or some sort of contract here because it didn't reference alimony. Now, whether it's enforceable or not, it's a whole other issue, but couldn't it be considered just contractual liquidated damages?
I think, Your Honor, the problem with calling it liquidated damages is that damages under Nevada law are very clearly meant to be a mathematical exactitude. Although not completely certain, they're meant to have certainty. They're meant to have either a date of termination or a fixed sum. This term has neither. This term is a fixed sum for a month, periodic payment that continues until either death or remarriage. That's not a hallmark of damages, Your Honor. That's a hallmark of alimony. It's set forth in the statute.
Are you also arguing that the language of the contract doesn't comply with Nevada law to create liquidated damages?
Yes, Your Honor. We've argued that it is clearly alimony if it's the statutory hallmarks of alimony. We're also stating that it cannot possibly be damages, either in tort or contract, because Nevada law states that damages are a finite sum. You can have an installment payment towards the conclusion of damages so that you don't have to pay the final sum immediately, but there's always a fixed total sum. This has no fixed total sum. My client could end up paying this $2,500 a month payment for another year. He could pay it another 10 years. He could pay it another 30 years. At that point, the final amount is completely speculative. He's already paid $50,000 and more. You know, if he pays this another 10 years, he's going to be, my math skills are not the best, I apologize to the court, but probably close to $1 million at that point. That's not, I don't see how that could be damages under the case law. In addition, those damages are relating to a contract that is novated into the decree, and while contract terms don't apply to a decree, obviously they do apply to settlement negotiations and the terms which are then input into the decree. And in order to have a novation, you have to have an underlying agreement that is valid. The underlying agreement is not valid. It's based on a contract for meretricious services. And in addition to that, you can't have damages in tort for torts that, number one of the torts isn't a tort recognized in Nevada. And even if Nevada chooses to recognize the tort, it's for potential tort damages, specifically the sexual battery tort, which Nevada has not yet recognized. But if Nevada does, the language in the decree still says for potential exposure to an STD. You can't have damages for a lack of harm.
Couldn't you sign a prenuptial agreement with these types of unusual clauses in them and all like that if the parties mutually agreed to it? Or do you think under Nevada law it would be void ab initio?
I think it would still be void ab initio, at least in this case, number one, because it's not a prenuptial agreement. This was entered into a couple of years before.
But it was later incorporated
into this decree. It was not incorporated. There's no prenup in this case.
Okay.
And in order to have that, you would have to have it being an anticipation of marriage. These parties weren't anticipating marriage when they entered into the underlying agreement. The respondent believed that appellant had cheated on her, and she wanted an agreement in case he ever cheated on her again while they were at that stage in their relationship. It was never incorporated into a prenup. There's no language in that agreement that addresses property, so there's no Western States versus Mischoff type of proceeding to hold community property, to address property in any other fashion. It is literally just an agreement that he will pay her a monthly periodic sum if he cheats on her again and they break up because of it. So I don't believe the underlying contract can be validated. I believe there are problems with the decree itself as to how the contractual terms within were negotiated. But ultimately, I think at the end of the day, it is alimony. It has to be alimony. Alimony is a creature of statute, and the statute says when you have an indefinite fixed sum periodic payment that terminates upon death or remarriage, that's alimony. That's not a hallmark of any type of tort damage. It is only a hallmark of alimony. It's laid out in the statute.
But your client didn't file the motion until way more than 6 months after the decree, and I'm concerned about how you get this under Rule 60B. I understand you're arguing that it's void, and therefore the time limit doesn't apply, but what was it, 3 years after the decree that the motion was filed?
It was under 3 years. It was over 2 years, but under 3 years. I believe it was about 2.5 years. Part of the problem, Your Honor, is that the parties stayed together. The parties continued in a relationship, and they even entered into a second domestic partnership within that time. As a matter of fact, the reason this came out is because appellant went to his counsel, to terminate that second domestic partnership based on the fact that the parties had finally separated. And it was only in looking at the termination for that domestic partnership that it became clear that there were problems with these terms in this decree. Appellant never had counsel in the underlying first dissolution. Frankly, he didn't know he needed it. The parties weren't separating.
Given a lot of admonitions, even in the document itself, what evidence is there that he was deprived of the opportunity to obtain counsel before this decree was approved?
He didn't know he needed counsel, Your Honor. I understand that he knew that.
Well, there's lots of pro pers who don't understand they need a lawyer until we get to this point, and then they discover they should have had one.
And I do recognize
but that's a lot different than a circumstance in which, what seems to be true in this document, he's admonished he should seek counsel. He's urged to do so. Notwithstanding that, he signs the agreement. And it seems like this fellow is about drafting his own contracts anyhow. That's how we got started in this whole show, apparently.
Well, he did draft his own contract originally, And he certainly was admonished. I would point out for the court that the admonishment was signed the day the decree was signed. So I don't know how effective it is.
Is there any evidence that that's a significant fact? I mean, was he drinking? Was he impaired? Did they tape him down where he couldn't get to a lawyer? I mean, really?
No, Your Honor.
Just because it happened on the same day.
I think the more important point is that he didn't know his interests were adverse. He had drafted his own contract. He did not draft this decree. Respondent hired counsel to draft this decree, but they went in knowing the parties were not going to be separating. It's clear from the terms in the decree. It's clear from the parties' statements throughout this litigation. They didn't separate until another year and a half and another domestic partnership later.
Can you address one thing maybe before you sit down? Maybe Justice Pickering will give you a little bit more time. But here's my question for both of you. It seems questionable that there's any causes of action that support these payments as tort awards. Assuming that that's true, how do you overcome the fact that your client signed the document calling it damages? It's a stipulated judgment. I mean, we get stipulated judgments all the time. Parties can enter into agreements to pay money, even though there might be some cloud or suspicion or uncertainty about whether that's actually due. What's your view about that?
Well, Your Honor, pursuant to day versus day, at least within a decree of divorce, a decree that is merged or incorporated with settlement terms does not survive as an independent contract. It is merged into the decree, is bound by the laws of the state of Nevada as a decree. That's in day, ironically, they were dealing with alimony, and the idea of whether or not you could contract around the modifiability of alimony when you merge into an agreement. So when you merge stipulated damages into a decree of divorce, I believe you're subject to the same terms. You have to review Nevada law at that point. Nevada law says this doesn't hold up. So I don't see how you can have a stipulated clause for damages that operates beyond Nevada law when a decree of divorce doesn't allow for contract for independent contract terms within the decree. Ultimately, I believe at the end of this day, this is alimony. It contains all the statutory hallmarks of alimony. I believe this was an end run by counsel to attempt to create a situation where you had non-modifiable alimony without having to openly negotiate for a non-merged settlement agreement. It doesn't hold up under law as damages, both because of the non-existence of at least one of the torts and the inability to have the other tort have all of its elements met. Because the damages are speculative, I believe the underlying agreement cannot be novated into the decree. And since it now is a decree, we have to look at what the provision says. The provision is alimony. It looks like alimony. It acts like alimony. It has to be considered alimony under the case law that exists. And because it is alimony, it is modifiable. It is terminable. As a matter of fact, it is terminated by the second domestic partnership. Because you can waive remarriage under the statute as a condition for termination, but you can't waive remarriage to one individual person under one set of circumstances. Either remarriage terminates or it doesn't. As a result, I believe that this has to be considered alimony under the law. And because it's considered alimony, it must be terminated by that second domestic partnership. Frankly, I believe to find otherwise is to overturn extensive precedent. The precedent that says that provisions that operate like alimony are alimony. The precedent that says that statements that are merged into a decree lose their independent contract status. The precedent that says that tort damages must be specified. The precedent that says you have to have actual harm to have a tort. That you have to have actual harm to have have contract damages. You can't have harm without those. You can't have damages without harm. I'd like to note for the court that it's not my intention here today to create broad sweeping changes in Nevada law. I believe this is an alimony case. I believe the case law supports this is an alimony case, and it should be dealt with as an alimony case to do otherwise is to create those broad sweeping changes that I think the court would rather avoid a setting overturning substantial precedent. It looks like alimony, it acts like alimony, it is alimony, and therefore it should be considered alimony, the term should be clarified to be alimony, and it should be terminated by the second domestic partnership.
You have only 20 seconds left of your reserved time. I'll add 2 minutes to the clock and 2 minutes to your opponent's time as well.
Does the court have any further questions?
Ms. Massell, are you going to reserve the rest of that time
yes,
for your rebuttal?
I think I will.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. John Jones appearing on behalf of the respondent. I think the questions that you asked counsel were a lot of what the argument I was going to be making as far as the ability for people to negotiate liquidated damages clause, stipulated judgments, even in cases where the defendant believes there's absolutely no merit, but for PR reasons, for any other reason, there could be no case at all, but because they don't want, because we live in a free country and people can sue anybody for any reason, and they don't want that to be out in the public eye, they settle the case. Doesn't mean that the resolution and the judgment thereafter is invalid because the plaintiff couldn't have possibly won their case. Now, Mr. Jones, let me ask you.
In trying to work up this case, and I think it required a lot of thought from all three of us in the Supreme Court to try and figure out the different legal theories and the applicable law. But let's talk about the liquidated damages. You know, I brought that up to Ms. Mestel, but here's my concern. Usually in a liquidated damage clause, they have a standard language saying that the parties agree to this amount because the actual damages are difficult to ascertain and some other language to that effect, and the parties sign off on that. Now, that didn't happen here. It was just this amount here with a normal disclaimer on liquidated damages. So as to your argument for liquidated damages, how would you respond to that?
Well, I think the appellant chose the damages in the contract. This was something that wasn't a one-sided effort from the contract standpoint. While it merges into the decree and loses its independent nature, people are free to contract, and district courts, and frankly this court, don't get to rewrite their contracts based upon the fact that after 32 months, they decide, gee, I don't like the deal I cut.
But can you contract for this type of behavior, though, under Nevada law? That's the key issue.
Well,
you're right. We agree people can contract, but you can't contract everything. You know, some things are prohibited by public policy.
But the agreement, but more importantly, the recitals that are in the decree. We have an NRS 47-240 issue where all of the recitals on what is Appendix 9, 10, and 11 represent conclusive presumptions of fact. And if we go through them, he basically represents that the agreement's enforceable, it's reasonable. All these arguments about unconscionability, unenforceability, they're gone by virtue of the specific language of the decree.
So, Mr. Jones, I have a question for you. Suppose this contract, instead of one for dealing with compensation for infidelity, had been compensation for committing murder. How would we have approached this? Would it have been appropriate then for the court to approve a decree that contemplated the payment of some amount for the payment for the completion of a murder?
Well, and that,
or
and that
not
goes
completing
back to
our, or not completing a murder?
Right, but that goes back to the fact that the contract itself, which may or may not have had problems standing alone, when merged into the decree, accompanied by the recitals that say, I mean, these recitals say that she's entitled to this money and that it's tort damages and contract damages.
Doesn't that require us, the hypothetical I posit, doesn't that require us to look through the decree and look at the underlying agreement to determine whether or not it violates public policy? I can't imagine, I suppose maybe, but I can't imagine approving a decree out of a family court that sets up an arrangement like this where the underlying contract has to do with the payment of some for committing a murder or not committing a murder.
And I understand that. I think to some degree
you wouldn't advocate for that, would you?
I certainly would not, Your Honor.
Well, so why is the public policy evaluation of that agreement any different than the public policy evaluation for this agreement?
Because the decree specifies the types of damages. I don't believe it's for this court or even the district court to say, emotional distress, embarrassment, physical harm, possible exposure to STDs, that this value was the wrong value, because it's the value the parties chose.
I'm not talking about value. I'm talking about liability. I apologize.
No, I'm sorry.
But once again, that gets back to the issue of stipulated judgment that you even asked about. People are allowed, and when we look at the actual judgment and we look at the history of the litigation, you have a complaint. So this idea that he thought they were on the same side, he was a defendant in a lawsuit.
But I want to pause you there and follow up on what Justice Hardesty is asking, because he's right at the heart of what's troubling me as well. This is not just a contract that is being asked to be enforced. This contract was taken to court and became the subject of a decree. So if the parties had characterized Justice Hardesty's murder example as an expenditure to improve the community property of the estate and therefore compensable in the party's divorce decree, the amount they paid for the murder, because this guy was threatening to sue them or something. You want us to say this is, we can't examine the underlying contract and the policies it embodies because of recitals in a stipulated decree. I'm troubled by that.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's factually distinguishable by something like murder, because these types of considerations are part of prenuptial agreements. There are bad boy, bad girl clauses in prenups that are enforced by courts. Obviously, we have no precedent here in Nevada, but there are provisions that deal with fidelity, deal with, and there are causes of action in other jurisdictions for being exposed to sexually transmitted diseases. So,
Stato case, the In re marriage of Marin and Dargan cases, both I acknowledge out of California, but nevertheless, are pretty clear that this is just not compensable as a matter of public policy.
And it gets back to the party's right and ability to decide the terms of their agreement in a decree.
Could you address the public policy point made in those cases? Are there cases from other jurisdictions that view this differently?
I don't have citations, Your Honor, but having researched it one time many, many years ago, I know that there have been causes of action sustained for this type of tort. But once again, you can go back and say substantial emotional distress. We all acknowledge that that's a valid cause of action, right? So when it goes back to whether or not the district court or this court can second guess the dollar value a party puts on any one of these things.
But in this California case, someone's infidelity is not viewed as a serious emotional distress for a IED claim or even an NIED claim. In fact, under the Franchise Tax Board holding, this probably wouldn't be compensable, period.
I understand that, but the parties determined that it was compensable. Parties can settle under any terms, even if they're not supported by law.
Let's assuming that we accept your proposition. How do we write an opinion that distinguishes between your argument that the parties have entered into this stipulation and this agreement, handed it to the family court judge who puts their stamp on the decree, from a case in which the underlying facts involve someone committing a murder? How would we set up a rule that distinguishes between those two circumstances?
Well, that'll help me, although I believe I've addressed it as far as what the actual decree says. But under this case, you have other outs as well. First of all, I still maintain that this is not an appealable decision. It's not a motion to modify alimony. The reason we know that is the decree says neither party pays alimony. So it can't be a motion to modify alimony. This is a 60B motion. This is, okay, we got to get rid of this provision and substitute a different provision for it. It's, first of all, so from the standpoint of Whether or not it's a special order affecting the rights of the parties, it's not.
Doesn't 60B4 contemplate this kind of a motion even well after the six-month period?
Well, actually, Your Honor, that is true, but there's a case that has already defined that 2 years was not a reasonable period of time, even on a void judgment. Sure. A void judgment is one where there's not jurisdictional grounds. Here you had a complaint, an answer, a stipulated resolution, an acknowledgement of self-representation. This court had jurisdiction over these issues that these parties agreed to. So it can't be void, but even if you said, okay, there's a potential, given the subject matter, that it could have been a void decree, he might have had up to 2 years. We already have authority from this court that says 2 years is not reasonable. So the timeliness aspect of 32 months, you know, I don't have to argue any further beyond the 2 years. From that standpoint.
Are they still living together of the 32 months?
Your Honor, I frankly don't know if they, they had already separated again. And had there been a subsequent action to dissolve their subsequent domestic partnership. Now, none of that's part of the record, though.
Okay, well, then don't tell me about it.
And that's
thank
why
you.
I didn't want to get into that, and I think counsel touched on it a little bit, some things that weren't part of this record. But from the standpoint of timeliness, they can't reach that. It's Deal versus Baines is what the case is. Okay.
Mr. Jones, I think I agree with you. If you're right on the 60B issue, then you win on the time limit here. If not, then we have to get into the public policy issues. Now, I want to give you another. It's not a hypothetical. It's a real case I had as a district judge here, but it plays off of Justice Hardesty argued. What if you have a case with a man and a woman? Let's say the woman lends the man money, and the man signs her promissory notes over a long period of time, series of notes. Now, doesn't pay. She sues to collect, and his defense is, this woman was paying him for sex, and so she doesn't owe the money. So that case is before the court. Now, you're the judge. What do you do with that? Is that a legitimate argument you can bring as a defense? Let's say you think it's true. Let's say, that's probably what it was for. How do you handle that?
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, I guess the evidence, you would have to be able to be in a position, and that's an initial case. It's not an appellate issue.
Right.
That is an initial determination.
But it's public policy is the issue. How do you deal with it?
Well, we have case law regarding the impropriety of agreements for meritorious sexual services.
Okay.
And frankly, this contract isn't one of those contracts.
Tell me why. Why isn't it?
Because they're already in the relationship, and it talks
but
about
it looks
settings.
Like she wants to leave for reasons that are probably inferred here from the whole agreement, and he's trying to keep her in the relationship. So he says, okay, if you stay, I'll pay you this money here, and I'll put it in writing and sign it, you know, like that. Is that a valid agreement or not, you know, under public policy? What's your position?
Well, I don't believe that that's what this agreement says. I don't believe the record.
Isn't that kind of
that.
What it is? It kind of looks like that, though, in reading between the lines here. So tell me if... You did the trial. Tell me if I'm wrong.
I did do the trial.
Oh, well, I mean, you're...
It was denied without a hearing on the motion, primarily on an untimely basis.
Okay.
And that's what, you know, the holding of the court was, he doesn't have this remedy available to him from a timing standpoint.
Right.
Things that, you know, I guess the initial determination is, A, is this an appealable order under NRAP 3A?
Right.
And then, B, if it is... Was it timely? Was the motion before the court, the district court, a timely motion? Did the court abuse her discretion in finding that this was an untimely motion? That's a standard that this record can't not nearly meet.
I agree. I mean, if we agree with that argument here. But let's say we don't. We got the second issue to deal with on the public policy. How is this different? I mean, it looks like he's... paying her to stay in this relationship, paying her $2,500 a month, you know, to do this. You know, how else do you characterize that?
Well, in this case, the judgment says what the $2,500 is for. And it says it in a way that it's a conclusive presumption. So we can't now dispute why he's paying it. He's not, and he didn't have to pay it until he acknowledged in the recitals that, yes, I signed this contract. Yes, it's valid. Yes, I breached it. I mean, there's breach. There's tort. There's damages for contract and tort recited in there. There's no duress. There's performance cited, and that she's entitled to the payments. And then it goes even further to say it's enforceable, it's reasonable, it's equitable, it's fair.
But the only way you could have the damages would be if they're either liquidated and they comply with the liquidated damage laws, or they're a stipulated judgment like Justice Hardesty discussed here. Other than that, there's no provable damages for this type of behavior, is there, under Nevada law?
It would likely be a case that I wouldn't take. I mean, to be completely candid with the court. But that goes
in the family law setting. I mean, is there any way a person could have a contract for an illegal object and then go to court and stipulate to an enforceable judgment enforcing the illegal contract by recharacterizing the conduct in that stipulated decree? I'm trying to think of how that would work in any other context.
I suggest to you that in the family law context, payments are made all the time in the context of stipulated judgments. One example is dad will agree that mom can have primary custody, but dad requires language that says she will not relocate outside of the state with the kids, and in consideration of that, dad is paying X dollars. I don't know. That's never been adjudged on appeal, but those types of things, while problematic from a public policy and free to move about the country constitutional basis, they are part of sort of the world that family law encompasses.
Well, do you think your decree could, in a normal commercial setting, let's take Justice Hardesty's example again of a murder contract. Let's say you wanted someone on your payroll that would commit murders, and the guy wanted a judgment. He didn't want to just take your word for it, so you cobble together a judgment that I'll pay you $3,000 a month to be on my payroll for murder, and we'll call it personal services, and it was a dispute, and we settle it, and we go to court with it. Is that something that is unassailable, despite its illegal object?
Well, if we take something along the lines of what's in recent news, somebody fathers a child, and it would be detrimental to him or her, detrimental to him, so he has to pay $7.5 million so no one ever finds out. You know, I don't believe that judgment or that resolution could be undone by that person at this stage by saying, gee.
But I'm asking a different question. I'm asking whether or not a contract, the ongoing performance of which would be illegal, can be gussied up and made the subject of a stipulation, and then by the passage of time become unassailable as a judgment.
Well, the passage of time issue I don't think can be changed.
Yeah.
Even if it was criminal, this is not criminal.
No, I understand that. The
example that you're using I think is factually distinguishable because there's nothing criminal here. There's tort damages, there's contract damages, there's an agreement and a stipulated judgment.
I'm hard-pressed to understand the tort damages, truthfully, but punitive damages.
Well, and punitive damages are part of it. I mean, we have a complaint and an answer that admits every allegation of the complaint, and then we have the stipulated judgment.
Your time is up. Thank you so
much. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Mustell, you have 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
If the court would allow me to address some of the questions you asked of Mr. Jones.
Well, first, the most important you should start with is his 60B4 argument.
Yes.
Where we've indicated that 2 years or longer is problematic. How do you overcome that?
And that was what I was going to start with, honestly. That case is very specific. In that case, it was a probate case. And the plaintiff appellant in that case waited 2 years to file her 60B4 motion after 1 year after receiving her allotment under the will, and 18 months after her attorney filed notice of entry of that judgment. So she had extensive notice of what exactly was going on. She'd participated in the underlying actual litigation, objecting initially to the terms of the will, participating in specific litigation with an attorney about those terms, receiving the judgment, her attorney filed notice of entry, then she received her disbursement, then 2 years went by and she said, oh no, wait, this isn't what I wanted. That's a little bit different than someone who, as a pro per, goes into an attorney's office, receives the paperwork to sign an agreement he believes will have no actual legitimate physical impact on his life, stays with that person, continues to reside in the same relationship, enters into a second legal relationship with that person, and then after separation goes to an attorney to dissolve that, and then suddenly finds out that there might have been a problem with this proceeding.
Do you maintain that the parties getting back together somehow tolls the period that would otherwise be considered under 60B4? And if so, are there any facts in this record that would support such a tolling theory?
Well, I'd like to perhaps correct the court on one point, which I believe supports that. The parties never separated. They went home together that day, continued to reside together. So there's no period of separation on which to base this. And
is both that on the record?
It is in the record. They remained together. They entered into that second domestic partnership.
Where in the record is that?
It's in both the motion, our opening brief, and acknowledged within, I believe, the respondent's portion of
are there any declarations or affidavits or any of that?
Other than,
you know, sort of stuff like evidence?
Other than the declarations which specifically support the motion and the opposition, there have been no other things, but I don't believe that fact was ever in context.
I didn't see any of those declarations that talk about we stayed together.
They're short form declarations like we use in family court, Justice.
Do you agree with me the declarations are silent on what you just said?
I agree that the specific details are not included, okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. I want to thank both counsel for their arguments on this challenging case. The matter will stand submitted, and counsel.